On an otherwise typical Friday night in 1994, a 17-year-old high school student in Northern Virginia was shot through his throat by an errant bullet from a fight at a high school football game. Trauma surgeons saved that young man's life, launching him on a career as a trauma surgeon and as a leading voice against gun violence. That young man was Dr. Joseph Sacrin, our guest this week on Story in the Public Square. Hello and welcome to Story in the Public Square, where storytelling meets public affairs. I'm Jim Lutis from the Pell Center at Salve Regina University. Alongside me is my friend and co-host, G. Wayne Miller of the Providence Journal. Each week, we talk about big issues with great guests, filmmakers, authors, journalists, and more, to make sense of the stories that shape public life in the United States today. To help us this week, we're joined by Dr. Joseph Sacrin. He's the Director of Emergency General Surgery at Johns Hopkins Hospital. Joseph, thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks so much for having me.
So, you know, we talked about this a little bit before, but you came from a really tragic, nearly fatal incident when you were in high school that sort of put you on a course to where you are today. But tell us what that incident was.
Yeah, so I was born just outside our nation's capital. I'm the son of immigrant parents who came to this country in search of those hopes and dreams that so many of us strive for. And at the age of 17, my life really changed when I went from being a healthy high school senior to someone that was nearly killed after being shot in the throat with a 38 caliber bullet. And you know, I don't know how the both of you were at that age, but I think most 17-year-olds, they don't realize that they're mortal. They have no idea what they want to do for the rest of their lives. And so that moment really inspired me. It inspired me to go into medicine. It inspired me to become a trauma surgeon. And then it really pushed me and inspired me to think beyond simply the trauma center or the operating room, and how can we work at that nexus of medicine, public health, and public policy, which is why I do what I do today.
Well, and so you are a passionate advocate too now about gun violence. When you were sort of making this foray through medical school and beginning your career, so you've been the victim of gun violence. What was the moment like the first time you actually saw a victim of gun violence?
Yeah, so, you know, it's a really great question, because initially when I got into medicine, my whole goal was to be able to give someone else that same second chance that I had.
That surgeons gave you.
Right, exactly.
Yes.
And I remember before I decided how kind of my life was going to be and the trajectory I was going to go down, I remember after my injury, I was standing in the restroom. I was looking at the mirror. I still had my tracheostomy tube in. My scars were beet red. And my father was standing in the corner. I didn't realize he was standing there. And I think he saw the look of devastation in my eyes. And he walked in and he said, "Listen," he said, "I know what happened was terrible, but you really have two options. The first is you can feel sorry for yourself. Or the second is you can take this horrible incident and try to impact the lives of other people." And so, you know, back to your question, like now being on the other side as a provider, you know, I have that unique experience of understanding what so many of my patients have gone through. And I think that gives me a little bit of a different perspective to relate not only to them, but also to their families and their loved ones.
So you have had to tell families waiting away from the operating room two things, essentially, if I can break that down. One is your child, your relative, your father, your mother, whatever it is, made it. And also, you've had to tell even, not even more, horrible news, devastating news, they didn't. Do you remember the first time you had to do that, the latter, tell a relative or relatives or friends that the person who'd been rushed in an ambulance and went up to the OR and disappeared from sight of the family and friends isn't there anymore?
Yeah. You know, I love what I do as a trauma surgeon. And I definitely think, you know, your point really hits on probably what I consider the worst part of my job, which is having to go into those waiting rooms and to discuss with families, with loved ones, that, you know, their child that left that morning is never coming home again. And the first time I did it, I was actually a trainee. I was at Inova Fairfax Hospital, which it just happens that that's also where I was a patient and where I was taken care of.
Oh, wow, what an irony, huh?
Yeah. And as a trainee, you know, you go in there with the surgical attending and you're primarily listening and watching the interactions. And I remember thinking, wow, how am I gonna be able to do that myself? It was so emotionally draining. And, you know, a lot of times we think of the impact on patients, the impact on families, but there is this emotional impact on healthcare professionals. In fact, Dr. Albert Wu from the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health talks about this in the terms of the second victim, and meaning the healthcare providers that are having to do this day in and day out and to face those realities. It's not easy.
And you know, that's an important point too. Surgeons don't operate by themselves, quote unquote, operate by themselves. There's a whole team of people, professionals in that operating room, before and after that operating room. So they're all affected.
Absolutely. It's a multidisciplinary approach that's required to take care of these critically injured patients. And by the time they come to our trauma center, really, this is in many ways the end game. We should be focusing on how do we prevent these patients from actually ever being injured in the first place.
Well, so we're it seems like we're perennially in a debate about gun violence in the country, and it usually spikes, it seems, after there's a big there's a mass shooting at a school or a church or a Walmart, wherever it may be. But the you experience this gun violence on a daily basis, on a nearly daily basis anyways. What are the levels of gun violence in the United States today?
Yeah, that is a really important point that often in the mainstream media doesn't get highlighted, because you're right, there's a focus on the mass shootings, which we're seeing, frankly, day in and day out. But the reality is that every day there are young men from colored communities that are being killed on the streets in cities like Baltimore, Philadelphia, Chicago. And their stories often go untold. But for us, from a healthcare perspective, we're seeing those injuries and those deaths on a daily basis. And so when you look at the mass shootings, that comprises less than 2% of the overall public health crisis we're facing.
Wow.
The majority of deaths are from suicides, about 2/3. Then the other big chunk are homicides. And then, of course, we have the unintentional injuries that happen. You know, right now in this country, we have 4.6 million children that live in homes with unlocked and loaded weapons. And if you talk to any responsible gun owner, they'll tell you that that's unacceptable.
You mentioned cities and gun violence, but it certainly is not limited to cities. You can go into suburbia and you can go into rural areas. You mentioned suicide, and I was thinking of that particularly. This is not limited to big cities, little cities, or just cities. Talk about that. This is a national problem that really reaches every part of this country, whether you've got 40 people in your town or 8 million like New York.
That's absolutely correct. And that's why how you look at the data is so important, because depending upon the location that you're talking about, the area, the type of injury and death that you're seeing could be different. And you mentioned suicide. So we know in suicide, right, it's primarily older white men. It's a very different demographic than we're seeing when we're talking about homicides and unintentional injuries. I think the reality, to sum it up, is we are facing a public health crisis in this country because communities all across this nation are facing this complex health problem.
We need to take a quick moment for station identification. This is Story in the Public Square, where storytelling meets public affairs. An audio version of this show can be heard four times every weekend on SiriusXM Satellite Radio's popular Politics of the United States. That's the POTUS channel, number 124. We produce Story in the Public Square with a remarkable crew at Rhode Island PBS, and we're lucky to work with them. I'm Jim Lutis. On most days, you can find me running the Pell Center at Salve Regina University in beautiful Newport, Rhode Island. And if you want to connect with me on Twitter, you can do so at J.M. Lutis. Joining me, as he does every week in the co-host chair, is my friend G. Wayne Miller, who is the author of 17 books and is also an award-winning journalist with the Providence Journal. You can find Wayne on Twitter, too, at G. Wayne Miller. And our guest this week is Dr. Joseph Sacrin, the director of emergency general surgery at Johns Hopkins Hospital and a prominent voice among physicians worried about gun violence in the United States. On Twitter, he's at Joseph Sacrin, J-O-S-E-P-H-S-A-K-R-A-N. What does that mean, though? So when you say it's a public health crisis, put that into sort of layman's terms. What does that actually mean?
I think when you think about a public health crisis, and we have had many, you know, throughout our history, we're talking about these complex health problems that you see in different geographic areas. And just, you know, one example. So in the 60s and 70s, right, we were facing significant motor vehicle fatalities. We didn't get rid of cars, right? We came up with seatbelts and airbags, and we made roads safer. And that's so important because the idea here is, right, do we want to change human behavior? Sure. But it's not cost effective to simply focus on human behavior. We have to develop a system where it's less likely for someone to get injured.
I wonder if you could get into another aspect of gun violence, which often gets lost in addition to the single victim deaths that you talked about between mass shootings, and that's gun injuries. We're not talking, in terms of a public health crisis, only deaths. We're talking about people whose lives are changed forever, some physically, some mentally, some both in terms of injuries that require support for the rest of their lives and the mental health aspect. Talk about that. I mean, that's another whole large group of people in addition to deaths by gun violence.
Yeah, that's absolutely correct. So when you think about the deaths that happen, we're talking really about 100 deaths per day, plus or minus.
100 per day?
100 deaths per day.
In the U.S.?
Now, in the U.S.
Holy.
Now, to your question specifically, what about when we're talking about the non-fatal injuries? Conservative measurements have that at about 2 to 3 injuries per death. But the reality is depending upon the state that you live in, depending upon the institute that you work in, our ability as a nation to comprehensively capture the non-fatal injuries is currently inadequate. We do not do a good job in really understanding the full scope of the problem. And there are downstream effects to that because, you know, some people end up paralyzed and needing to be put on a ventilator for the rest of their lives. I mean, there's so many.
So explain that to me, though. So we have, the federal government is a Hoover vacuum cleaner of information and data and statistics, typically. Yeah. Why do we not have that kind of data about gun violence?
I think it's a couple reasons, one of which is right now when you look at this problem, it really requires a multidisciplinary approach and a multifaceted approach. And right now, a lot of these databases that we have are siloed off. So, you know, the hospital doesn't communicate with the police department. The police department doesn't communicate with the medical examiner's office. You know, we need to break down those silos and get people to actually, you know, communicate on the same page, to be collecting, you know, similar variables so we can look at this in a more comprehensive way.
It's sort of like epidemiology.
Yeah, exactly, which gets me to the next point, which is, you know, we have really had a moratorium on research over the past 20 plus years, ever since the passage of the Dickey Amendment. Now, just to be clear, there's never been a ban on research. The Dickey Amendment simply said that they're not allowed, the CDC is not allowed to promote or advocate for gun control.
The CDC, the Center for Disease Control, not allowed to advocate for gun control.
Exactly.
Okay.
But the problem that happened was, in addition to that amendment, Congress also stripped the CDC of $2.4 million. Now, that's not a random number. That's the same amount that they had spent the year prior in firearm injury prevention research. And so when you talk to the leadership at that time, they will tell you they were afraid that they were going to go bankrupt and it was going to really drive them down. So they kind of backed away from this.
Is this just ideologically driven? Is this the NRA agenda to stifle federal funding and federal research for gun violence?
Well, I think what initially happened and what even led to this amendment was there was an article that came out in the New England Journal of Medicine by Art Kellerman and his colleagues that essentially said having a firearm in the home increases the risk of homicide and suicide. And there was a big backlash by the NRA at the time to try to combat some of the attention that that brought, which is what led to the Dickey Amendment and everything that kind of followed thereafter. Here's the reality, is the gun lobby, the leadership of the gun lobby does not represent the membership. And we have seen that in so many examples, time and like literally on a daily basis. Most recently, when you look at universal background checks,
The
majority of the American public and the majority, frankly, of gun owners and NRA members support having universal background checks, but the leadership is unwilling to move on this issue. And so I think that's just one example of how they're not really representing not just their own membership, but the American people.
Why is the leadership not willing to move? Because you're absolutely right. I have friends who are gun owners who agree with everything you just said. They were like background checks, limits on magazine size, perhaps even limits on ammunition you can buy, and so forth and so on. And these are reasonable people who own guns. I mean, a lot of people own guns.
Yeah.
So why is the leadership so strident against?
It's a very good question, and it's one that I wish they would actually answer. The reality is exactly what you said. Gun owners, this problem is not with gun owners. You know, I've gone to places like Oklahoma and Kansas and talked about this issue. And you know what I found is that as Americans, we have a lot more in common than we have that divides us. And you know, you hear the leadership talking about this slippery slope. Well, if we do this, we're going to want something else. The reality is this is a complex health problem. There's no one solution. Closing these loopholes when it comes to background checks is not the only thing we have to do. It has to be literally a multifaceted approach in order to reduce firearm injury and death in America.
You know, so after the shootings in El Paso and in Dayton, the president made an address to the nation, and he initially indicated some willingness to do something about background investigations, but that seems to have waned. But he also talked about mental health and video games, violent video games. What role do those things actually play in gun violence? And is it a legitimate part of, should it be a legitimate part of the conversation, or is it a distraction from the central issue of proximity and access to firearms?
Yeah. So when you look at mental health, let's just start with that. We know that there is a correlation between mental health disease like bipolar disorder, schizophrenia, depression, and suicidal ideation. But it is absolutely and categorically false when you try to equate mental health with these homicides that we're seeing or these mass shootings. And in fact, less than 5% of people that commit these type of crimes actually have mental health disease. And in fact, people with mental health disease are 10 times more likely to be victims. So I think it's a real fallacy to be, you know, broadcasting that type of narrative. And it's a way to really skirt the issue. In regards to the video games, I mean, look at Japan. Japan has some of the most violent video games,
yes,
and they don't have this problem, right?
Yeah.
Why is that? It comes down to one thing, and that's how easy it is for us to have access to firearms.
So in addition to your professional work, your speaking, your media appearances, your appearances at conferences, You have fairly recently taken to social media, and I want to read a tweet from the NRA that I think was that prompted your response, and you can get into what your response was. But this tweet came out toward the end of last year from the NRA. Quote, someone should tell self-important anti-gun doctors to stay in their lane. Half of the articles in Annals of Internal Medicine are pushing for gun control. Most upsetting, however, the medical community seems to have consulted no one, those two words capped, but themselves.
Yeah.
What did you think when you read that?
Yeah, so I remember that day so vividly because I was coming home from a long day at work and I was sitting on my couch when I noticed that. And my response was simply a very visceral response and said, no, actually, you know, we're the ones that are having to talk to these families. We're the ones that are front and center of taking care of these patients. So actually we do have a role to play in this public health problem. And this is actually our lane. And what I realized at the time, and I didn't know what type of effect it was gonna have, is I realized that when we saw the response across social media from clinicians, not just doctors, it told me that we were really looking for a platform where clinicians, people that are front and center of taking care of these patients, could actually have a voice on this issue. And that's how, you know, This Is Our Lane came about, was really to provide that platform.
What is This Is Our Lane? Flesh that out for us.
So This Is Our Lane essentially is an organization, a group of individuals, doctors, nurses, you know, other healthcare professionals that really want to show the public, right, exactly what we face day in and day out, and want to see action-oriented change on this issue. And what we saw was an exponential growth in the movement. It's not just one moment. This is a movement that is not willing to stand on the sidelines of history as people continue to be injured and killed on a daily basis.
How do you think this, let me put it this way, are we ever going to see action on something meaningful to address gun violence?
I think the answer is yes. So it can be frustrating because we have seen so much inaction at the federal level.
The issue that sort of I'm still not over is Sandy Hook. Yeah. This is the murder of innocents, literally. 6-year-old first graders and their teachers, and that we could not as a society muster any meaningful action after that is a pox on all of us.
Absolutely, Jim. We have to also look at it this way, though. In America, most governing in America happens at the local and state level. Yeah. And so last year, there was over 67 pieces of legislation, right, that passed in states all across this country. And what we have also seen is if you look at, and this was just recently published in the New York Times, if you look at the number of A-rated members of the House, in 2008, there were 63 Democratic members
rating.
Of the House. Yes,
yeah.
NRA rating.
Yeah.
And now there are 3 members that have that A rating. So there is a paradigm shift. And frankly, you know, shame on us, not having the moral courage to do the right thing. And we've seen the young people in America really actually re-energize this country when it comes to this movement.
So I just wanted to mention, you are the founder of Docs Demand Action, another social media and group, and you're also on the Brady board. To talk about that just briefly, and then I have a larger question.
Yeah, so, you know, I am a board member of the Brady campaign, and I am founder of Docs Demand, and This Is Our Lane. And the way I look at my role is, again, working at that intersection of medicine, public health, and public policy. I think each of us as citizens, we have both the possibility and the responsibility to have a voice in this issue. And there are different ways to do it. And what I've tried to do is bring together clinicians all across this country to ensure that they actually have a voice when it comes to gun violence prevention.
So you use the phrase all of us, and that of course extends to all of us. We are coming up pretty fast on the 2020 election. Where do you see gun violence in the context of that?
Yeah, so what's interesting, and this started to happen in 2016, and we're seeing it even more so in 2020, is gun violence prevention is a central piece of every one of the candidates that are running. If you look at their platforms, every one of them, it's part of their campaign. Why is that? It's because there's been a paradigm shift. And I think, you know, Vice President Biden said it the best recently, where he said, these are just not statistics. These are human lives, right? These are mothers, fathers, sisters, and brothers, people that are part of the fabric of our community. And I think we have to have simply the moral courage to do the right thing, to say, we're not trying to get rid of firearms. We're just trying to ensure responsible gun ownership.
You know, I'm curious. So, Hugh, this has affected your life in profound ways since you were a teenager. What's the one thing, if you had the head of the NRA or just John Q. voter or Jane Q. voter in front of you, what's the one thing you would want Americans to know about gun violence?
I would just want them to know that, you know, gun violence does not discriminate. It can affect any or all of us. And again, the most heartbreaking moment, I wish I could take some of these individuals and bring them in with me to these waiting rooms, to these ICUs. You know, I recently took care of a 17-year-old patient that was shot in the back of the head. And I had to go to the surgical ICU and talk to his mother and tell his mother that her child was never coming home again. And, you know, as I did that, she began telling me about her son, how he was the first to graduate from high school, which in Baltimore in the African-American community is a big deal. He had hopes and dreams of going to college just like, you know, so many of us. And as I told her, you know, the story, she looked at us and she saw us as the medical community, how torn up we were as well. And she walked over and she put her hand on my shoulder and she said, are you okay? Just imagine that for a second. Here's a mother that just lost her child and she's asking us if we're okay. We have to ask ourselves, what, you know, we're so resilient as a community, but what does that do to the American psyche to have to day in and day out be resilient to these senseless tragedies that are happening?
It's a powerful place to leave it. Dr. Joseph Sacrin, thank you so much for being with us. That is all the time we have this week, but if you want to know more about Story in the Public Square, you can find us on Facebook and Twitter, or visit pellcenter.org, where you can always catch up on previous episodes. For G. Wayne Miller, I'm Jim Lutis, asking you to join us again next time for more Story in the Public Square.